So this is Saturday the 17th of November 2018, and I'm meeting in Yangon on Saturday morning in the Melia Hotel with Wu Ting I'd like to just start at the beginning, if we could.
Yeah, we can begin from the beginning. Yeah.
So tell me a little about your childhood and your parents.
Well, I was born in a little town called Pew. It's midway between Manly and England. My father was a public prosecutor and became, when he retired, he was an assistant attorney general. I had there were six in our family, and I'm the youngest. So when war broke out, we couldn't stay in Pew or in Dango, but we had to stay in the village. But that didn't do well, so we came up to Rangoon, and that's how I started. So after the war.
What year were you born?
1933, November. I'll be 85 on the 27th this month.
Well done.
So I went to school. It was going first when the British came back, we had a school named Mrs. Nelson's. It's on the Wizara Road. I was there for a couple of years, and I moved on to Teachers Training College. Now it's a favorite, quite well-known school. I was educated there, stood for my matriculation exam. I didn't do well at school, but I had to sit twice for my matriculation. But since that time, I wanted to become a diplomat. So after taking my honors degree in economics, one of my CRs told me that if you plan to join the Foreign Service, you better start, go back to 1 year, the back copies of The Economist, London Economist. That's a required reading, according to John F. Kennedy. I went back 1 year, back then. I stood for the public service examination. There were about 500 candidates. Fortunately, I stood first. So my professor, who is Dr. Tan, a product of Harvard University, who won the World's Prize for the best thesis at Harvard, came and told me, "Hey, teacher, you did very well." I didn't know that I was there. Anyway, I became a third secretary, probationary third secretary, full-fledged third secretary, and from third, second, first, counselor, and then ambassador. I was a career diplomat. I didn't come, I wasn't flown up by a helicopter or flown down from a parachute or anything.
The helicopter?
There are a lot of them. We call it, yeah. Those homegrown, you know, and those who came from above, took up from a helicopter or from a parachute. A lot of, at that time, the percentage was about 1% for a career man to become ambassador. It was monopolized by the army. Anyway, I was in Tokyo from 1985 to 88. So in 1988, when we had this mass uprising, I was in Tokyo. Very, very. And Dosuchi was there on the west. And I heard the speeches, and we used to watch all these televisions. The Japanese took a lot of interest in Burma, because I was there as an economic counselor, and we were getting a lot of aid from Japan, about $500 million a year. Anyway, I was looking after the economic affairs, and then we were, you know, the economy was getting down, and in order to get cheap loans, we had to apply for the least developed countries to get an interest, very low interest rate, not the London LIBOR rate. So we got it. Actually, we were way above other countries in the area. At one time, Rangoon was the shopping center. We had practically all the airlines in the world. You name it, Pan American, Air France, BOAC. At that time, it's called British Overseas Airways Corporation, not British Airways. They always called it British Overseas Airways Corporation because always late. We had Scandinavian SAS, Air France. It was here from Rangoon. Rangoon Airport was the biggest then at the time. It was the biggest. From here, they had to go to Peking or Singapore or Bangkok. They came here for, like, we go there. Our people go there to Singapore or Bangkok for shopping. They come here for shopping in Rangoon. Our airport was the biggest airport. All our airlines touched on here. Okay.
When was that though?
Well, in the late 50s. We're doing very well. And then at the time we had a, you know, parliamentary democracy, Westminster style, everything. We copied everything. And of course, at that time, we had this anti-fascist people's FBF. It was run by Unu and his colleagues, Uchonye, Ubaswi. They were socialists. Unu was, she's a playwright. But anyway, the party split, you see, between UNU faction and Chonye faction. Because of what? I think you have a French say, chercher la femme. Because of women, right? UNU's wife and U Chonye's wife didn't go along. That's why how the split started. So in parliament, there were communists, neo-communists, socialists, anti-fascists, everything. And when we wrote our constitution, there was a clause allowing these states to secede from the Union. You see, the British policy was divide and rule. We had these frontier areas, the Shans, the Kachins, the Chins, the Karens, the Karenis, they were all under different administrations. It's a divide and rule policy. So when the Shans started to talk about seceding from the Union, Unu invited General Ne Win to take as caretaker of government. So that's how he tasted blood. I think he came to like it. I think he stayed for about a year or two. Then we had another election. Who knew his party won? At that time, I was in New York serving under U Thant. At that time, U Thant was real. I mean, at that time, there was only one organization called Afro-Asian Group. And U Thant was leader. He became very popular. Then we had this Hamish Show died, his wife paying his way to Shandar, and they were looking for a person to succeed Hamish Show. And U Thant tried to play on this program. At that time, nobody thought that they would appoint as an Asian man. You know, brown man. Only from the, it comes from the Nordic countries like Sweden, Norway, or Denmark. So he was played an honest poker. And eventually, I used to tag along with him. He said, Mr. Tan, why are you looking for a man? He said, why couldn't you do that to it yourself? But at the time, they always talk about, the Russians are talking about troika, three horses, pulling, you know, troika. There will be three secretary generals. That the Americans have nothing to do. The French have nothing to do. So they asked, at that time, Bolin from Ireland was a popular sort of candidate. But whatever the Americans pick on man, the Russians would say no, yet. But that's what the Russians said, the Americans would say no. So they eventually said, Mr. Tan, why don't you do it yourself? Fortunately, Uno is back in power. Uno and Utan were friends. So I remember saying, Utan had to ask permission from Uno. He said, I've been asked to act to become elected. Take it. Go ahead. Utan became secretary.
It was a wonderful honor.
Oh, yes, it
was. And he did a good job.
He did a good job. And when, you know, at that time, the Burmese delegation, really, you know, we were very proud of him and how used to it. But he was our permanent representative. He was along the corridors, the American ambassador, the French ambassador, the British ambassador, the Russian ambassador would say, Mr. Tan, along the corridors. Anyway, that's it. Then we had this, back in 1962, I was in New York, and we had a coup d'etat. Julio came to power. That's how it began. And they had this, to make it sort of, they had to call it the Burmese Socialist Program Party, PSPP. It's a mix up of Marxism and Buddhism and everything like that. Well, that's how you have these, they have this monopoly of the economy, they call it. They still have it. But eventually we had this uprising back in 1988.
It's a long while though, isn't it? 62 to 80.
Yeah. People are really getting fed up with it.
Did it affect your career?
Well, not exactly. I happened to be the most senior man abroad. And of course, we had to back, you know, our people from in Rangoon, foreign people, were asking the support of our embassies abroad to give us our support. Of course, we sent us. At that time, you see, you have to belong to a PSPP party to become an ambassador. So anyway, they called us back, and then we thought we were going to be all going to be fired. But they needed one man, at least one man, to handle this foreign affairs. So they appointed a career man, Uon Jo, as first as Director General, Deputy Minister, and Minister. He became the Foreign Minister. At that time, we were a sort of an international pariah. But Uon Jo tried very hard to become a member of ASEAN. So, if the credit should go to Uon Jo, who made it possible to become a member of ASEAN. So we became somebody in the.
When was that?
Oh, back in 1977, something like that. Eventually, we became ASEAN.
So, when you were all called back in '88, what was that for?
Because practically every embassy abroad, the Burmese embassy abroad, people backed the uprisings.
And how did they know you backed it? What did you?
Well, I thought I happened to be the most senior. They thought I was the ringleader.
Where were you then?
I was in Tokyo.
You're in Tokyo.
Okay.
So what? How did you manifest your support for the students?
Well, we had to send up, okay, we support what you're doing. Up there is a group in the Foreign Office here in Rangoon organizing all these things, support. So, okay, we join.
So did you send your support?
Yeah.
Support we had to sign the students?
Yeah, students. Did you know the uprising?
Right.
So we were called back. We all had to meet in Bangkok, all the insurgents.
And so, a government minister came to that?
Actually, I thought we would be sent to the, I have this call it called the AGI, where they interrogate people, you know, run by the military, the MI. So I asked my wife and my daughter, look, you know, prepare me a pistol, a jacket, so that if I take taken away, so that I can wear. But anyway, I wasn't sent to that place, but I was interviewed for 6 hours. 6 hours.
In Rangoon?
In Rangoon.
Yeah.
And they took a mugshot, like, you know,
like
American gangster, you know.
Were they trying to scare you?
Yeah, they did. 6 hours, it grilled me. He said, hey, it must be the ring leader, because you are the most senior fellow. I said, no, I didn't canvas for any. I just signed it because I liked it, because I like multi-party democracy. And then at that time, Dr. Mama was became president for, one president was only for 17 days, 1-7. It was a sham. I said, no, I wasn't a leader, but I like an ultimate. Oh, no, you must be a person. You can ask him. It took me 6 hours. I thought they would fire me, but who owned you? A lot of people are fired. See. They got sacked. I know yourself, but if I'm to really run the ministry, how can I work with, you know, new people? I must have some people who have experience. So they kept us, few of us have kept.
And Japan is important.
Oh yeah.
So you went back to Japan?
No, I didn't go back, but Japan was important in the sense that we were getting a lot of aid from Japan. You know, both, what they call it, JICA, under JICA, both in terms of loan and in terms of grants, mostly loans, but very low interest rates. Very low, about 2.5%. At that time, LIBOR rate was about 6%. So we had got these loans, and we had these projects called the Mazda project in the car. We had the Kubota pumps, we had the Hino buses, we had the cars, and things like that. And then we were not able to service our loans, you see. They couldn't pay back interest. So eventually, I was going through the papers and we were charged with the LIBOR rate. I said, I met this Japanese, he was a director general. You see, the Japanese, I don't know about now, right now, the system is, even a director has a lot of voice. Don't tell about the director general. So I met this man. I said, look, we are a least developed country. We should be earning very low interest. We are paying about 6 or 7%, like a LIBOR rate. He said, no, it's not possible. Please, I said, listen, you better ask, check your department, Asian department. And he said, you also inform your deputy prime minister who is coming to Japan about this, and then you tell him, and I'll tell my. So at that time, it was Nakasone, who was the prime minister. Our deputy prime minister came, he went and saw it, and I told him about, look, Mr. Prime Minister, the Japanese have $500 million reserved for us as loan and grants, you know, and we won't go to the Paris Agreement. They call the Paris Club, what they call, you know, to get loans. We're not going to go to the Paris. We don't have a lot of costs. All we have to have Asian Development, ADB, Japanese Foreign Ministry, new Foreign Ministry, and then one. We do it very quietly. That's what. So I told him, yeah. So when he went, he called on Nakasone, and he came back, he said, look into your line, what you said was true. So he went back, then this came the uprising in 1980.
And so what happened to you after that?
After that, Unjo insisted that I need some people who have experience, and I became a director. This is about a senior counselor rank in the embassy. And then they needed some people. They would like to, you know, appoint some civilian ambassador, career man. So Uonjo picked me as ambassador, first to Nepal for 1 year, and then to Geneva as a PR in what they call the UN office in Europe. Geneva is much busier than New York. All the things are sorted out. You have the ILO, you have the, you know, WMO, everything there. The New York session is not that, the New York office is not that busy. But it was in Geneva. It's in Geneva where all these things, human rights, everything.
So it was an interesting posting.
Very interesting, but a lousy job. Lousy in the sense that I was trying to defend the indefensible. You know, human rights. At that time, it's called the Human Rights Commission, not Council.
And what were the human rights issues that they
had? Oh.
Forced labor.
Yeah, forced labor, the labor problem, forced labor, dictatorship. And then we had this same problem with the Bengalis. We call it Bengalis. We don't like the term Rohingyas.
And that is your counselor certainly doesn't like using that word.
All of us, including myself. They are still Bengalis.
Because Rohingya gives them a sort of a semi-ethnic
status. Yeah, you know, I think yes, semi-autonomous status. And I think their aim is to have another state under the union, their own state. That's why they want to have citizenship rights. They want to become citizens. I think 99.999 of the Burmese are against it. So Dos Suchi's job is not that easy. So you can't blame her. But she's told Mike Pence that you don't know about Burmese. In some ways, she's right. All of us are against it.
Can you see a solution?
I don't think so. You know, the Bengali, the Bengal, they are much, they're brainy people, the Bengalis. You know, they have some, I think 150 million people there, and our clothing manufacturing industry is coming up. Bangladesh is earning about $5 billion a year sending clothing, shirts, things like that. But we are also doing very well. So we have a very stiff competition between us. And that is one of the reasons why they're looking for it. And they have the old OIC behind them, you see, 53 countries behind them. Out of 193 countries, 53 are from the OIC.
And are they the Islamic countries?
Or? Oh, yeah, all the Islamic countries. Backed by Saudi Arabia, money men, money countries. I hope this crown prince will not do anything to, like Khashoggi, huh?
But it seems to be, as I mentioned earlier when we first met, you said 99.99%.
Yeah.
You know, I've met a lot of Burmese. I've never met any Burmese who...
What did they say?
None is sympathetic.
Not sympathetic. Sympathetic is very, a poor sort of substitute. We are against it.
But would you accept that the military have gone too far? You don't think it's been raping and purging?
Well, they have to, because they started, I guess they have this terrorist, game, ourselves. They have to tell them that, don't mess up, don't mess with me, with us.
It's sort of an Israeli approach.
Yeah, don't mess with me.
So can you go back to your, let's complete your career then. So you were in Switzerland?
That was my last posting. Then I was about to be 60, retirement age is 60. So I said, please let me go back. I was getting burned out.
Because
it's a lousy place in the sense that it's a very unpleasant place, meeting all these people.
Yeah.
And they treated us like pariahs. But at that time, we were not a member of ASEAN. But these ASEAN fellows, they were very kind to me. They knew that I was a career man, not a political appointee or a military man.
So they're very sympathetic. They treated us in the same way as
sold membership.
So they gave the career guys the bad jobs.
Yeah, they exactly.
Yeah, well, I guess a military man in that job there would be.
I think that they would shut. You know, they would just shut them out. All they wouldn't dare. They wouldn't dare criticize. They knew that I was a career man.
So you haven't been retired 27 years.
Yeah,
really?
I'm still earning a pension. You remember that? At one time, my pension was about 2,700 jets. Not dollars, I'm talking 2,700 jets.
Was that at the 4-to-1 period? Or was it,
after my retirement.
Yeah, but then it was
monthly pension was 2,700 jets.
Right, but the official rate then?
At that time, the official rate was 6 jets.
Right.
That's what the government says.
So really, that's like $270 a month. Is in US dollars, isn't it? And what's happened now?
Now they raise it to do. I'm earning about 1,700,000.
What's that?
Jet.
1,700,000.
No. 1,770,000.
170,000.
This is getting me. It covers my, vitamins and things like that, okay, to keep me healthy.
But can you live on that?
No, I can't. Okay.
So every pensioner here from the government cannot really afford to live.
Yeah.
So how?
Fortunately, when I got married, my wife had the good sense to invest in the land which I'm now living. It's about 1 acre. At that time, it was quite cheap, my present day standard. So I sold the land, got the money, built a little house, then invested in the bank. I bought some shares, and I'm living on these shares, dividends.
The shares outside?
Yeah, well, the first private bank. The first private bank ever, they call it. That's how I'm living.
And without that?
Oh, without that, I'll be on the street, you know, begging.
So what about all the other people who didn't have that? How do they live?
I don't know. So do you know some people, they have their children supporting it. Some people are working in Korea, or mostly in Thailand.
Yeah, but you can't go to 87 and work in Korea.
Oh, no. But, I don't either, because the Japanese need some young people to look after, because Japan is an aging society.
Right.
So they need laborers to look after the aging. So a lot of people are interested, young chaps, young girls.
So what have you been doing in your retirement?
What do I do? I read The Economist. I read the Time magazine to get informed, keep myself informed. I come here to this Seasons Bakery every day, have a cup of coffee, listen to music, do some shopping.
And you mentioned you have a daughter.
Yeah.
So she's in what?
She's in Albuquerque. She's an American now.
And how did that, she was with you obviously in New York. Is that how it happened or?
No, it was off. No. I got married back in 1977. It was off to New York. At that time I was still a bachelor.
But that's quite an old bachelor, right?
Yeah. I got late married, 40 in the 40s. That's why my daughter is. I was just fooling around. You know, all the good places, New York, Washington, Rome, London, Geneva, Tokyo.
And you leave out Australia.
Then when I got married, our first posting with the family was Australia, my daughter and my wife. They really enjoyed.
So the story of how she's ended up in America, what happened?
Well, she suffered from what they call the cancer of the pancreas. Pancreas cancer. Pancreatic cancer. She died here.
That's your wife?
Yeah.
Your daughter?
No, my daughter is.
How did she end up in the United States?
Well, actually, she's quite a bright girl. She sat for the, what they call, efficiency in spoken English. Call it. And then set one, set two, and applied for scholarship. She got very good high marks, and she was given a scholarship by Bard College, back in New York. and the radio. Scottish.
So it was from here?
Yeah.
From Myanmar to there. And so what, she only went a few years
She
ago.
Went there, she became a graduate.
Right.
And then she fell in love with this, her teacher. They got married.
Okay.
At the time she was still a, you know, Burmese citizen, but you have to become a citizen, otherwise. I can go to America. I have a green card.
Do you have a green card?
Yeah, I do have a green card. But I don't know. I'm quite happy here.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Your friends are here.
And my friends are here. I can move around. I can't afford to have a taxi, you know, in Albuquerque traveling. It's very cheap here.
So why is she in Albuquerque?
She's in Albuquerque. She's a college graduate. She has got a master's degree. And now she's sitting for a law school. And I think she'll be graduated. She'll get a law school. She'll become a lawyer.
And her husband?
He got divorced.
Got divorced.
Childless.
Childless. That's sad.
Yeah. Well, that's life.
So go back to your childhood, because you skipped over that. But what it was like being a young boy in Yangon in 1935, when you're 36,
no,
you're born 33.
No, back in, by that time, I was. You know, when war broke out, we left Tambu and Pew and came up to Rangoon. And then, of course, we had this air raids, American bombers, British bombers coming. And then we had another second, when the Japanese occupied Burma, we had to. Then there was no schooling during the Japanese regime.
And is that for
no schooling?
A year, 2 years?
Well, we were just, there was no school at all.
For what, how long?
Well, for several years. But when the British came back in 1945, 47, they had this school called Mrs. Nelson School, which teaches English.
And ironically, your nickname is Nelson.
It's Nelson, that's right, ironically. So I attended this school. It's on Louis Arrow. It's still there. It's not a school anymore. Then they had this teacher's training college. So
you went straight from that school
to the teacher
street. It was primary and secondary.
Yeah.
So, and then went. And what about your siblings? You're one of six, you said.
Well, one was the airline pilot.
Here?
No, here. Airline pilot. In fact, he worked for Singapore Airlines. At that time, we had very few Singaporean pilots. So he was one of the captains of the Singapore Airlines. We had to send doctors. We had to send airline pilots.
Yes.
Doctors.
Yeah. Qualified.
Qualified doctors.
Tincture lane. Maybe you should have a cup of some of your coffee or
so. Well, anyway, Singapore is.
So that's one. One was an
light
airline
years
pilot.
Ago.
One was an airline pilot.
One was another as a marine.
Which
so he became
popular.
A captain, yeah.
That was very popular
yeah.
at that time, wasn't it?
Very popular.
Because you earned
foreign. No, quite a lot, yeah.
So he stayed in the Merchant Navy?
No, yeah, Merchant Navy. And then eventually, I think he got some contracted disease or something, and he died in Bangkok, my elder brother. And the pilot also died of cancer.
So who's left?
I'm the only child left.
The only child?
Yeah, the youngest.
Oh, you were the youngest. Okay. Well, so the others sound like they might have had a pretty long life, too.
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, I don't really know about it.
And was it your father was obviously
he became, when he retired, he was the assistant attorney general.
Yeah, it's a senior position.
He couldn't get the attorney general post because he was not politician.
Right.
Somebody took the AG's office because you have to have some connections, political connections. He was well qualified to become attorney general.
Still a very senior position. Right?
Yeah, very senior position.
Yeah. And what sort of father was he? What sort of father was he? A disciplinarian? I mean, what was it like?
Oh, yeah,
the
disciplinarian.
Those days? Was he like a British father? Or
yeah,
he
like a British father. Very disciplined. Upright. And he became also a legal advisor to the Bureau of Special Investigation, where they had corruption. He took no bribes.
So that's a distinguishing feature of that era, that from what you say and some of your friends say, the civil servants were proud to be...
Oh, yeah, they were very proud. Of course, we have... another thing is, we have these secretaries, mostly ICS men, you know, or BCS. They did.
ICS was the Indian Civil Service, which is a very elite.
Oh yeah, British trade. Then we have the BCS. They used to run all the ministries.
And a lot of them, of course, were Indian. Is that right? And has that created a long-term issue here, do you think, or not?
Well, they also, you know, because of the, Furtenwald wrote about this, British administration, colonial policy. We imported a lot of Indian labor to plow the fields. We had chattiyas, money lenders.
Yes, that's correct.
Money lending. Yep. Very exorbitant rate.
Yes.
You know,
what
they got.
They ended up land.
Yeah, they became landowners.
Yeah.
And the farmers became
lands.
That is colonial part. And they divided rule.
Divided rule.
Yeah.
Divided rule. By bringing in
foreigners
to run foreigners, the
country. Yeah. All these, what they call frontier areas to farm.
Right.
They have and they have a governor.
So you, in a sense...
We were part of India at one
time. Yeah, that's correct. So in a sense, do you hold, the British did not leave behind a functioning system that could have...
Yeah.
And can you see a possibility that these ethnic states will be able to succeed, or will it be...
I think we have a long way to go. No, they all have the idea.
I'm sorry?
I think it'll take a long, long time.
Right.
It's not going anywhere. All these talks about peace.
And why is that?
They want to have a real federal democracy where they can have their own, parliament. Like they have their own, like the American state, what they call it.
Or Australia.
Australia. Yeah. But they're not, these chaps are not like that.
If you look at the British system, could be going the other way, the same thing. But is there no concept that the Burmese would allow that to happen, a truly federal state?
I don't know. It will take a long time.
Long time.
Even they are fighting among themselves. Don't talk about the but they are landlocked. The Kachins are landlocked. The Karens are landlocked. The Shans are landlocked. And the Chins are landlocked.
But some of them have links, have borders with China.
Oh yeah.
That's another issue.
Another issue. Well, a Chinese friend, we have to rely on the China. We have these people coming. China is going to use their veto if the Security Council decides to put these men up to ICC. So we have to rely on our big brother. Well, Uto Gonshi, the historian, doctor, who is that? A historian. He should know much better. The Chinese look at us as a tributary state.
Vassal state.
They're center,
Mandalay, maybe
Middle Kingdom.
Mandalay has almost already become one.
Oh, yeah. Chinese city. We are quite dependent.
So, what about the links with China then? How do you see those?
We can't antagonize them. That's sorry. It's our big giant neighbor. We can afford to antagonize India, but not China.
So India is less of an issue than China.
Okay.
And it seems that, again, the government has made some strange decisions lately on with China. Over China, yes.
But does we with
it? Yeah.
What can we do? We're going to have this
this port in, you know, Middle East, all they're not going to go through the straits.
Yeah, back to Yunnan.
Yeah, they can pump the oil and gas straight from.
So, how do you see the future? With some, you know, looking forward now, with all your experiences.
Well, I hope the people, as I'm talking about, the common people's standard will be better, much better. But now we are all suffering.
And are you suffering more than you were?
Oh, I'm feeling the pinch because of the cost of living.
But would that have happened even if the military had remained in power?
Well, they have, you know, they have these cronies. They have billions and billions of dollars abroad, not here. They are not even spending their money here. So, we are doing very well. The economy is doing now.
And it, just like I said to you a little earlier, we both agreed that 99.99% of Burmese, you know, feel the same way about the Rohingya.
We call it Bengali, it's not a Rohingya.
I know you don't like me using the term. But it seems that most Burmese I talk to now are less happy with how things are than they were.
That's for sure. That's for sure. Our hopes were dashed. We thought life would be much better, but now we are worse off.
And why are the reasons for that? What are the reasons?
The cost of living.
But is the current government not doing enough to?
Well, they have these old fogies not running the government. They don't listen to what they do. They think that they are doing all right. They lost them in the elections very recently. They're going to lose a lot of seats. In 2020, I'm telling you. If I'm still alive, I think I'll be able to vote. I'm going to vote the opposite party. My vote will go.
Which is the opposite party?
Yes, Union Solidarity. The other USCP.
And that's the military.
Yeah.
And that is.
They know how to run the country.
And that is quite an amazing situation, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure you voted for NLD when they won. Did you vote when you had the vote? Did you vote for NLD?
Of course I voted for NLD. Yeah, because I thought life would be very better.
Correct.
But I've changed my mind.
Correct.
If I'm still alive, I'm going to vote USDP.
And do you think many of your friends have...
Yeah, they will do. Well, at least we have some crumbs come down, you see, to eat. Not the meat, but the crumbs and things like that. Bones. At least there were bones and the crumbs to eat during the USDP period. But now we have nothing to eat.
It's a very strange situation.
Very, very strange. It's a tragedy.
You're after 87 years, having seen what you...
Yeah, well, you know, they have the parliamentary Westminster star, military dictatorship, semi-military dictatorship. Now it's supposed to be democracy.
And when Ne Win came in 62, were people unhappy, or were they? What was the feeling then?
They were not unhappy.
Not unhappy.
Because at that time it was not that. So. Of course, there was. There was no. The newspapers couldn't write critical articles. Of course, but they did something. So. They did something. At least the people can live.
What about nationalisation of businesses?
Oh, no, that's a soup. They went too far. They nationalised everything, even the Beatles shop. Yeah. Would they like to do that? They would like to do that. Socialists.
Yeah.
But he was not actually a socialist. Ne Win was not actually a socialist. He likes to gamble. He likes the horse races. He likes to have tea with Her Majesty when he comes to London. Although he's actually a socialist.
If you could, I've not asked anyone else this, but for some of the people who are listening, he was quite a suspicious, superstitious man, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Like you had the currency notes.
But you know, even numbers, odd numbers. That also was one of the things which triggered the uprising. The demonetized number 9. bother for me.
It was very confusing for people like me to try and work out.
Well, he had this as his sort of deputy. He's a fortune teller. He reads the palmistry. He said, "Oh, you have to get it." In some ways, he's quite sophisticated.
Was it the notes were 6 and 9 and no decimal? And he made some decisions based on astrology, didn't he? On astrology.
Although we still have the Fourth of Independence is advised by the astrologers at 4:30 a.m. in the morning, 4th of January.
Sorry, say that.
That's auspicious. 4th of January.
Yeah.
It was set by the astrologers.
Which the election?
Yeah, election of Independence Day.
Right. Okay.
We still believe it. Whenever we get in trouble, we go to the fortune teller. He's dreaming. I used to go there and I sat for my exam. But I still believe in palmistry.
It's a funny balance between rational thinking.
We can sometimes become very irrational. Muslim when we are irrational. But we still believe in palmistry, fortune teller. A lot of people go there. The fortune tellers are not running out of business. They're doing quite well.
Even now?
Yeah, even now.
What does it cost to go to a fortune teller?
Well, perhaps it'll be about $2,000
$3,000. $2,000, so that's like $2, $3.
Not too expensive.
But people
go there. Whether to build a house or whether to move house or whether to, you know.
Do you think people actually make the decision based on what the fortune teller tells them? Or is it just sort of getting comfort?
Yeah, it's something comfort too. Oh, yeah. Of course, he knows it. He knows. He very knows. Who would go and visit him when you are not in trouble? He knows that something is wrong with you. Okay. Otherwise, why should I go and see a fortune teller if I'm doing very well? Why should I? So he knows psychology. He can see what this man, this woman is. I think that must be a problem with the husband, the son. Fortune teller is quite
still
thriving,
quite
business, thriving business.
Thriving business.
Mentally. We don't do anything without consulting. But when to build a house, what time to build a house, when to move in, when to move out. See the calendar.
That somehow links a bit with Buddhism, do you think? Or
it's not, actually, really, it's not pure Buddhism.
Yeah.
No, nothing. I think it's a mix of those other.
Yeah.
Hinduism and that.
What's your view on, was it Mahabharata, you know, Mahabharata, the extreme...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I will support him, but you know why? Because I don't like this woman, Yanghee Lee, the special rapporteur of Burma.
Of the UN.
Yeah. She's I don't like her.
You don't think so? He's
right in saying that she's a whore.
But it's not, for me, it's not a very Buddhist way of...
Well, she is trying to, giving us a lot of trouble at
the
Security Council.
Yeah.
She is the one who is calling the shots. She is the one who is calling the shots.
Of course.
Not asking the Bengalis not to go back. Yeah. It's not safe to go back to Myanmar. Don't go back. Ask for your citizenship. Yeah. Become a citizen first.
No, that's why I can see you may have issues with her. But what about the extremist monks?
Well, we feel the same thing with him.
So really, he's expressing
the feeling of the people.
But it's not a very Buddhist,
In that case, we don't care about Buddhism. We are nationalists. Yeah?
Nationalists.
Yeah, I'll tell you, 99.999 against them. They can go to hell. Whether they come or not, they don't. We're going to fight. I'm going to volunteer. I'll take my part, whatever I can do.
This is an 87-year-old man speaking.
Yeah. 87.
87.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tin Cho
Lion. Lion. Lion.
Lion.
Lion.
Lion. Lion.
H is not silent.
It's not silent. Well, look, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. But, well, I said what I want, what's in my heart, how I felt. That's how. Maybe I'm prejudiced. It was probably I'm prejudiced. But that's how I feel.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.